meeting to order this morning of the In-State Energy Committee. I'd like to let the record reflect that the committee is convened at 7:30, promptly 7:30 a.m., February 19th, 2013. The following members are present today: co-chairs Senator Coghill, Senator Machicki. I'd like to welcome our Senator Giesel here this morning in attendance, and I think we'll have a couple other senators that are previously taken away, but will be here in the not-too-distant future this morning. And myself, Senator Bishop. I'd like to recognize our staff today, Mr. Dickrell, Senate Records, Lori Berg, our LIO moderator, and myself, Click Bishop. My committee staff is Pete Fellman over there in the corner. Pete, good morning. And today we have Sarah Fisher, Goad, Wayne Dope,
Dioc,
Simoniak. I got that one. Nick. Good morning from the Alaska Energy Authority. They are here today to present an overview of the Susitna-Watonna Hydro Project. I'd like for to welcome everyone to the table, and please state your names for the records. I would just like to say just a little bit of history on background. This is a project that I think could have a 100-year long-lasting effect to the positive for the state of Alaska. I know we're in the incipient stages of going through this and walking through this, and you guys are going to give us that presentation going forward. I mean, I've always been a big fan of hydro. And interesting to note, just for a little bit of history for the room, in 1984, I took the original camp out of Devil's Canyon, and it was moved, ironically, to Bradley Lake for the first man camp for that hydro project. So here I am, what, 30 years later, and we're still talking about Susitna. So with that being said, I'd like to recognize Senator Egan has joined us, and Senator Wilikowski, welcome the gentleman this morning, and thanks for coming. So, Sarah, you kick it off. It's all yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Sarah Fisher Goad, the Executive Director of Alaska Energy Authority. I have an easy part. I'm going to just go through a couple introductory slides and then have Mr. Simoniak come up and finish the presentation with Mr. Dioc. And thank you for those introductory comments, Mr. Chairman. I think it's been exciting to have the Alaska Energy Authority continue with this project 30 years later. We have made some significant progress the past 2 years, and very very happy to give this update to the legislature. The legislature should have received the 2012 report, which is a summary of our activities from the last year. That was put into the legislation that we are required to provide a report to the legislature every year. So I hope that you found that report has been informative about our progress. So as we had gone through an AEA overview before, and just to emphasize again that our mission is to reduce the cost of energy in Alaska, the four bullets represent our primary strategies for doing this. And what we're going to talk about today is really the first bullet, the investing in Alaska's energy infrastructure, and actually also diversifying Alaska's energy portfolio. So the project, I think, touches many things that, of course, the AEA's mission is about. So our energy challenges, we do have varied energy costs by regions. This is not just a rail belt region issue. We have aging facilities in the state. There is, of course, declining oil production that this committee is very well aware of, and there is the highly volatile fossil fuel costs, which is one of the reasons that many years ago the legislature asked us to dust off the reports from the 80s to see if a large hydro made sense for the rail belt region. We do have dispersed communities and no central grid except a limited grid through the rail belt region. So the AEA has a portfolio of programs to address short and long-term solutions for the energy challenges that face Alaska. So we do have a renewable energy goal that was set in 2010 for 50% renewable by 2025, and this project is a significant way that Alaska will achieve that goal. Currently, our electricity sources, and we've actually just recently updated this because we did want to recognize, too, that hydro is 21% of our resources right now statewide, but you see that there is a little sliver of other renewables that is showing up with the introduction of wind in the rail belt at Eva Creek and then Fire Island Wind. In addition to the wind resources at in Kodiak, we are seeing additional renewable resources coming into that portfolio. So our renewable resources, though hydropower does make up 90% of our renewable resource. All the others equate to about 10%, and again, those are primarily the utility scale and some of the smaller scale wind projects that we have throughout the state. I think what's really important to recognize here is hydropower has been a significant resource for the state of Alaska throughout its history. In the southeast area, in Juneau in particular, has seen hydro be extremely significant in their primary electrical generation resource. In southeast Alaska, also in Ketchikan, Wrangell, and Petersburg, other projects that were originally built by the Alaska Energy Authority continue to serve those projects and provide some of the lowest cost power in the state of Alaska. So this is my slide to also transition this over to Wayne. The hydro history of Susitna has been studied since the 50s. In the 80s, of course, as you mentioned, Mr. Chairman, the significant work that was put in to develop the project originally. Of course, this project has looked significantly different and has been scaled back to a smaller project. But I did want to mention, you know, when we were looking for a project manager to lead this effort, I was introduced to Mr. Dyack at a conference in Girdwood, and he had worked on the project in the 80s. And so what Wayne brings with us to the state of Alaska is over 30 years of experience working on hydro projects throughout the world, but also specific history and a history of working on Alaska projects, in particular this one. I've told Wayne that one of the things that we should put on the slide is a picture of him from the 80s, and then one today. But we've refrained from doing that. But it's still something we can do maybe in the future. But anyways, I did want to mention that we're real proud of the team that we've built to help work on this project, and led by Mr. Dyack. The preliminary decision document that led to Senate Bill 42 giving AEA the authority to do this was something that former Senator Thomas from Fairbanks and Representative Craig Johnson were very instrumental in pushing and funding the Alaska Energy Authority to really look at large hydro. And so we did do an analysis of both the Susitna project and then also the Chacachamna project. And we had developed a preliminary decision document that really did show that Susitna was the project to pursue. And in particular, it was really a lot of the work that was done in the 80s that really provided a significant amount of information for us in order to be able to pursue this and work on a goal to really get this project underway by 2024. So with that, I am going to turn it over to Wayne to go over more of the study, the project information, and also have Nick come up to talk about some of the economics of the project.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Wayne Dyack. I'm with the Alaska Energy Authority. So why are we moving forward with the Susitna? What kind of project? Well, first of all, the project would serve about 80% of the state's population. We'd be able to provide about 1,000 jobs during a peak of construction. But more importantly, the stable electricity prices for more than 100 years, projected life of the project, places throughout the United States that have had hydro for 100 years, those places really do exhibit the lowest prices for their rates. Diversification is another key aspect. The Susitna-Wetana project certainly isn't the solution for everything, but it does help us diversify our energy generation portfolio. And it is a clean, reliable, you know, energy source. And one real advantage of a hydro project like Susitna-Wetana is you can use it to integrate the variable resources like wind that are not necessarily dependable, whereas hydro is very dependable. So maybe just a few highlights of the project. The project dam site is approximately 184 miles upstream from the mouth of the river and 87 miles upstream of Talkeetna. There's a barrier, or let's call it an impediment, a 10-mile impediment at Devil's Canyon that inhibits anadromous fish from, you know, getting, you know, upstream, although some certainly do get upstream of the site. And as I said, as Sarah mentioned, the product would provide about half of the energy needs of the, you know, the rail belt. A couple of key facts about the you know, the project. We're looking at an installed capacity of around 600 megawatts, and we expect around 2.8 million megawatt hours of energy on an annual basis. So we've been evaluating, you know, three alternative routes. These routes were also known in the 1980s. As you know, there's no access there now, so we're in the process of evaluating each of those options. We don't expect to have a final selection until we complete both our engineering and environmental analysis, as well as interact with the, you know, the landowners and people that have an interest in the product, as well as the resource agencies.
Can I ask you a question on the your two corridors? That Shulitna corridor, has it ever been traversed? Because the Denali corridor, that's the corridor basically that we use to bring the camp in and take the camp out.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. The most westerly part of the Shulitna route, there's an old pathway or route that goes in a certain distance, and then from there it would be an overland, you know, unique route that has not had much in the way of travel. Okay. So a little bit on the timeline. As Sarah said, the project resurfaced in the 2010, you know, time period when the state established the energy policy of 50% renewable goal, and Susitna-Wetana was one mechanism by which we could, you know, meet that, you know, need. So, you know, since then we've been, you know, working, you know, quite hard. 2011 was spent primarily introducing the, you know, the project, getting people up to speed on it, and reviewing much of the materials that had been produced in the 1980s. We produced a what's called a pre-application, you know, document, and filed that with the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. At the end of 2011 and 2012 was spent primarily developing a robust, you know, study plan for the product. We'll get into a little bit on that. And then we also did some preliminary field work last year to get a handle on the studies, as well as, you know, see how the system has changed over the last, you know, 30 years. So we're just in the implementation phase of the two major years of study. We received on February the 1st from the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission study plan determination of 44 of the 58 you know, studies, and we expect that on April the 1st the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission will approve, potentially with some modification, the remaining 14 studies. We met with the resource agencies last week, and at the end of the meeting the representative from the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission said that they had enough information now to make the determination on the final 14 studies. So We'll do those studies. The goal is to file a license application to the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission in September of 2015. We wouldn't anticipate getting the license until the early part of 2017, and then it would be a 7-year construction period. And hopefully the project would be online by 2024.
Senator Machicki.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I have a little bit of energy background, but none in hydro. 7 years is a long construction time. Is that sort of typical for this kind of a project?
Through the chair, Senator, for a project of this magnitude, you know, that's pretty typical. Yes, we'd like to be able to, construct it, quicker. One of the challenges that we have, being in a northern environment, we're not able to place concrete for the full 12 months per year. And so we had to look at the critical, path items, and there are a number of things that kind of fit together that require a 7-year period. But we will be challenging, assuming the project continues to move forward, the detailed design engineer with looking at expediting the schedule. And I have a slide that will speak to that a little bit later. So just a little bit on employment at this point. Right now there are on the order of 385 folks that have been working on the project. Most of those folks are Alaskans, and we're supplementing that with experience primarily from the Pacific Northwest. We have a fairly substantive field program scheduled for this coming summer, and we're anticipating that around 180 people will be out in the field, collecting different types of environmental information and geotechnical information.
Mr. Doak, before we move off of that slide, in my former life, employment's a big thing for me, and Alaska Hires a big thing for everybody, I believe, in this committee. I would like to see AEA, I started this in my former life, the discussion, but work closely with the Department of Labor. They have a template down there that we can lay right over this for employment modeling for a project of this magnitude. So I would encourage you to reach out to the department and start those discussions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So as I mentioned, that we had prepared a study plan, and the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission had approved 44 of the 58 studies, and as Sarah said, I've been doing hydro work for many, many years, and truly this is unprecedented when you look at the level of effort involved in just developing the study plan. We worked very closely with the resource agencies, Alaska, Native entities, and interested members of the public to develop that the study plan. When we filed the proposed study plan in July, I looked at that and I said, well, this is a really formidable document. I don't think anything's been done like this. Well, we then spent the next several months working with all the parties and fleshed out the studies a lot more, have a lot of detail, and I think it's a pretty formidable document. And when FERC approved 44 of the studies, we were very pleased, in general, with that process. For the most part, they approved the studies without change. There were a number of studies that they added a small amount of additional requirements, to that. But in general, it was pretty much what we had worked through with the other participants.
Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you talk a little bit about what sort of research you plan on doing on the impacts to salmon? I've been getting a lot of emails and concerned people coming to me about the salmon and the fact that you'll be running water in the winter. And can you just talk a little bit about what your plans are to ensure that we're not going to impact the salmon run any more than it already has in the Susitna drainage?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, that is certainly one of our major focus areas for our studies. So what we're looking to do is to take the information from the 1980s and its historical information, and then look at the system as it stands now and develop a habitat based analysis, which means that you need to look at things like flows, how flows are affected by the project, how water quality is affected by the project, and then translate that to how the habitat would be affected through modifications in the flows and water quality. We're also working very closely with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. They're collecting an enormous amount of information, you know, out in the field, trying to understand the fish distribution and abundance. We conducted some initial studies, you know, this year, you know, looking at that. We're going all the way down to, you know, to Cook Inlet in our studies, identifying, you know, where they come from, where they head to for their spawning, and then looking at each of the different life stages, and we'll be modeling the effect of the project on the different, you know, life stages. So all these things are very important, and it's a fairly substantive program to really get to the heart of how the project might affect the anadromous fish, and then we'll look at those effects and see what needs to be done to make sure that the effects are mitigated.
Follow-up?
Thank you. And this to me is probably one of the bigger concerns that I have. Do you plan on keeping the legislature informed with reports on what you find? And then also, if you could just talk briefly, I mean, how does, as you release water in the wintertime, I mean, does this, I'm assuming during the summertime, I mean, can you talk a little bit about some of the impacts that we've seen in other dams around the world, and what the concerns might be that we should be looking out for?
Through the chair, certainly, Senator, we'll be happy to keep you informed. In terms of effects, certainly the whole goal of the project is to store water during the summer, runoff period, so we can use that potential energy in the wintertime when it's needed most by Alaskans. So you look at the effect of the flow change, and that's pretty much standard. Obviously, immediately downstream of the project, you're going to have your largest impact, and as you get tributary inflow, it attenuates, but you have to look all the way downstream. So the water level changes, and how rapidly those water level changes have the potential to affect the fish. Of course, one of the things that we would like to be able to do is to fluctuate the flows somewhat, so that we can best meet the needs of the rail belt. So you have to look at the effect that you could potentially have on the fish, both anadromous and resident fish, and balance that with how you would like to operate the product if you were free to. So we'll be looking at those kinds of effects, and I would say that sort of the bigger ones in the wintertime, and let's go seasonally here in the wintertime, you're going to have that reach of river between the project and some point downstream that will be free of ice, and that's pretty typical of what you would see in Canadian hydropower projects that operate during the winter. So there's a stretch of river that will not have ice, and then you'll have ice that will form downstream, and then you need to look at how that development of the ice would affect the the fishery, and then how you would operate that would affect the fishery. And in the springtime, typically the flows come up. We have the opportunity to be able to adjust the flows, and that's one of the beauties of a hydro. Once we understand how the system works, typically we'll have a milder breakup because we have more control over the flows. You'll still see a fair amount of rapid increase potentially in the Talkeetna and Chulitna rivers that come into the Susitna downstream, but we'll be able to manage the the flows, so you'd see kind of a milder breakup. You would have more stable flows in the summertime because of the operation of the product. Certainly lower flows, so you have a water level effect associated with that in the summertime. And again, we have to look at each of the different life stages and how they're affected by those lower flows, and then react accordingly. So those are mainly the things that you would be looking at, how you affect the the water levels and how that really translates into habitat.
Thank you. If you could get with ADF&G and just have them get back with the committee, I just have one little request to, at this point, is what streams have they identified as spawning streams?
Thank you.
So as I mentioned, we started some field work on the project in 2012 with Fish and Game, so we have a fair amount of information. Interestingly enough, much of what we're finding is very consistent with what we learned in the 80s. The downside of things, unfortunately, is the populations are certainly not what they were in the 80s, particularly for the anadromous salmon. Just going back to the revised study plan, as I mentioned, we spent a significant time over the past year developing that. The real key is to work with with the stakeholders to make sure that we have all of the issues identified and are fleshed out well enough so that we can file a complete license application in 2015. So that's really our goal here, is to make sure that the work that we have speaks for itself in a very objective manner. So in addition to the environmental aspects, let me talk for a moment, if I can, about the engineering and licensing. Well, we have met all of our major deliverables over the past year. The two critical ones, of course, were the proposed study plan in July and the revised study plan in December. So in addition to that, we've also been spending a fair amount of time looking at all the information that we have from the 1980s. There are 3,000 reports, and it takes a fair amount of time for our experts to be going through those and then looking at how that fits into the current program. From an engineering perspective, I would say that what we're into is a refinement and optimization process. The good news is we have some great geotechnical information from the 1980s. That has not changed. That's the one thing that we can say. The rocks that were there haven't really changed a whole lot. And so we're in the process of taking that information and refining things like the type of dam. There's been some significant developments in dam types, so we're looking at a roller compacted concrete dam now. And we spent much of last year looking at an optimized height of the project for what we could afford within the state and how it would best fit into the rail belt energy demand that we have today. So we've looked at that. We've also brought on a panel of experts. These are world-renowned experts. Interestingly, both we and the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission determined that bringing these experts on would be the right thing to do. Normally, you don't bring them on until you actually get into the detailed design phase of the project, but we felt it was important to get that information out now so we'd make sure that we have the right project for the state of Alaska here.
Does the Corps of Engineers still model these in Vicksburg, and can you give the committee a little background on that? I built one dam, not by myself, but I've been on a dam project, and you can go to Vicksburg today and that dam is still in the Corps of Engineers facilities. Okay, they model it. But
yes, they do, Mr. Chairman. That's exactly right. They still have. I can't recall what the organization is called. It used to be called the Waterways Experiment Station, but they've gone through some changes. Yes, they still do that. I think the most current project that they did a physical model of was on the Ohio River, where AMP Ohio was building, four hydropower projects totaling about 200 megawatts, and they looked at the specifics of how the flows and sediment transport would be affected by the construction of those projects. So that still is done. Mathematical models have come a long ways, since then. So most of what we would probably be doing would be analyzed using mathematical models. But I suspect as we get into a couple of areas, we will want some physical modeling. We've been in some preliminary discussion already with University of Alaska, Fairbanks, that may have some ability to do certain modeling studies for us.
Thank you.
So one last thing before we go to the next slide is the in 2012 we undertook a fairly significant geotechnical program to help fill in some of the missing information that we thought we had from the 1980s, and then we conducted an independent cost estimate. One of the things that our board and the team felt that we needed to do was to not just rely on one engineer's estimate for study costs, but to really get a second opinion. And we felt that was really important to do because cost is such a big driver in the overall rates that Nick will talk about. So we put out a request for proposal, and we selected a company called AECOM. And one of the advantages of AECOM is they have a tremendous amount of hydro experience. They're actually ranked by Engineering News Record as the best hydroelectric developer, and they have a tremendous amount of Arctic experience. They have an office here in Anchorage, but perhaps more importantly is all the work that they've done in Canada building projects. So we contracted with them, and we gave them the quantities that we had developed for the cost estimate as of January of last year. So they had a fair amount of information on quantities, and then we asked them to develop a cost estimate as though they were a contractor building the project. So they took a slightly different approach than you would have the engineering design, but then we asked them to meld that back into it. So they looked at it just like a contractor would be bidding the project, and they based it on the 2012 market conditions up here in Alaska. So they had to come up with unit prices, developed the field crews, the number of field crews. It's a formidable document, and I think they did a fabulous job in laying that out. And so some of the things that they were able to confirm is that the timeline that engineering design consultant had developed was reasonable and feasible. That the roller compacted design is definitely applicable here in the Alaska cold climate, and they actually thought we could save some time. Getting back to your question, Mr. Chairman, on the overall schedule by figuring out ways to extend the shoulders, if you like, of the construction season, and then some aspects they felt we could put. Under some kind of climate control, large tarps, and do additional construction concrete to expedite the process and perhaps improve on that. And then they felt that one other thing we could do is begin filling of the reservoir and have power generation on a little bit earlier while we were still finishing the project. Perhaps the most important finding, though, was the comparison between their cost estimate and that of our licensing and design feasibility study engineer is the cost estimate. They were within 9%. And considering that a year ago when we testified here, we were at a plus 50% minus 30%. I think that the 9% is helping us to hone in on the costs. They felt that their costs were within about 25% of what the cost would be given the 2012 market conditions. So the last slide that I'll talk about here before turning things over to Nick is a probability distribution on cost, because we want to make sure since cost is so pivotal, that we have a pretty good handle on the overall cost. So what we did was we looked at it's usually about 20% of the items that are responsible for 80% of the cost. So we looked at those 20% of the items, and we did a Monte Carlo approach where we ran real literally thousands of you know simulations of different errors that we might have in our estimates, either unit pricing estimates or quantity estimates for those components, and we came up with a probabilistic distribution of the costs. The actual cost that we estimated for the project, when you go through what you think are the most likely, was about 5.09 billion. But when you look at the Monte Carlo assessment, you end up with the median price being 5.19 billion, or say 5.2 billion. And then you look at, well, what's the spread of that? And that's the slide that you have there shows that within the 90% range, so you're going to be somewhere between about 4.5 billion and about 5.9 billion. And then what we said is, okay, for our studies, we're going to look at that median value, the 5.2 billion. So that's what we gave to Nick to run in his economic analysis. So with that, I'll turn things over to Nick.
Thank you. For the record, Nick Shimoniak, project economist, the Alaska Energy Authority.
Welcome.
Thank you. The first line I want to start with is essentially the same information that Wayne just presented, but laid out a little bit flatter with the numbers up at the top. So you see the 5.19 billion for best estimate, and then the blue bar signified that 90 percentile confidence interval, moving out to the pink, which is showing up on the monitor, which is the min and max. Moving ahead, this next slide, it's a pretty simple slide. I don't want to spend a lot of time. I don't think we need to. But I think it's important to talk about this before we start talking about the economic benefits of the San Quintana project. What this is just a simple demonstration of the impacts of inflation over the course of the life of the project. We see year one, 2013, we have inflation just indexed at one here. And over time, we see this red line creeping up. That's just the impact of inflation. And then in 2024, we have the dot and the blue line shooting out flat. That's the San Quintana power cost that's just representative indexed. And you can see the cost of everything else continuing to increase. I think in the box here I've got natural gas, construction, income, housing, even new hydro. So that's the dynamic we're really playing with, and that's the dynamic we're really tapping into to get the benefits of this project, is everything's going to continue to get more expensive, while the cost of power from San Quintana is going to be pretty stable over the course of the project.
Do you have, excuse me, because I know people are looking at this, Do you have track records for other dam projects like Hoover Dam? Has it been flatlined? You know, can you show a comparison to maybe in the future? Or
Mr. Chair, I don't have that with me, but that would be a real interesting exercise, and I think we could put that together pretty easily.
Thank you. If I could add on the Bradley Lake project, which we have really good experience on, when that project went online in around 1992, the price of power was around 4.5 cents a kilowatt hour, and today it's still 4.5 cents a kilowatt hour. So it really, you know, verifies that straight line approach. The bottom line is you're basically, buying a structure just like you would a house, and your payments are staying the same throughout that period. So your operation and maintenance cost for hydro is typically a very small portion of the cost, and that's why you're able to keep the horizontal, line there for costs through time.
Thank you.
And then, of course, when you get your house paid off, you're in good shape, and I'm sure Nick will speak to that, too.
Senator Machicki has a question.
So the incremental, maintenance on turbines and the cost of human resources and things are such a small piece of it that they don't?
To the chair, Senator Machicki, that's correct. I don't have the exact percentage, but it's a relatively small share. And you'll be able to see in some of the future charts how it slightly ticks up. It's not perfectly flat. But it is there, and it's pretty minimal.
Okay.
So flipping to the next one, these are the base case economic assumptions we use to generate the cost of power from the project. We took a very conservative approach here with many of these assumptions. There's some optimization that could be achieved. Starting the $5.19 billion for the capital cost, we're assuming the 2,800 gigawatt hours per year of electric production. And we have it in right now an interest rate for the financing of 5%. There may be some opportunities to find lower cost financing, which would directly reduce the cost of power from the project. The debt term, the term of the financing is at 30 years. Again, there may be some opportunities to finance part or all of the project at longer terms, 40, 50 years, which would also reduce the cost of power, especially in the early years. The annual income cost, this is the $16 million. This gets at your question. It doesn't show the actual annual cost. I believe the annual, I think this would probably be about 2% of the annual cost of the project itself, give or take a little bit, but pretty minimal. And the operation start year, we have it at 2024.
Just a quick follow-up. So really, that's your only incremental cost increase of a, you know, $5.2 billion project, is that $16 million a year will increase by 2% a year or something moving forward, and it's just such a small piece. That's why the operation doesn't increase dramatically.
Senator Machicki, through the chair, that's correct. And that dynamic is exactly why I started with that fund inflation slide, because that really gets to the root of where the benefits of this project are coming from, correctly identified. The next slide, these are the outputs from that model we ran with those assumptions that went into it. These are the Susitna-Wetonda power costs that we're estimating. And if you're more of a visual graphic person, we'll go into this visually, but we'll put the numbers up here for those that are number inclined. The year one rate of 18 cents is in 2024 nominal dollars. That's what it will be in dollars at the time when the project comes online. In 2013 dollars, it will be about 13.8 cents. And it's really useful to have both numbers up here. The 13.8 cents is the number you'd use if you want to compare it to the current cost that you're paying, your current electric bill. And that would be in year one. And you see that over time, the 10-year average, the 25-year average, and the 50-year average gets cheaper and cheaper. And the 10-25-year average reduces in cost in real terms because of that inflation. Everything else is getting more expensive, but the cost of power is staying the same. So in a sense, the cost of hydropower is actually getting cheaper in real terms. And you can see the 50-year average rate actually drops off pretty significantly, down to about 6 cents per kilowatt hour. And the reason for that is we're using that 30-year debt term. So after the 30 years, really all we're paying is that inflated cost of the $16 million a year, which is very minimal. It will be very cheap power. And another important note that this is assuming no direct state financing. In the model itself, we've taken the funding that we received to this point and the funding that's in the capital request this year. We've actually modeled it as being paid back with interest at that 5%. And that's trying to take the most conservative approach here and to not try to, you know, worry about that too much. And the zero-year costs don't drive the project costs too much. So as promised, this is the visual representation of what we saw in numbers on the previous slide. If you start with the blue line up at the top, that's in nominal dollars. You can see it comes starting at about 18 cents per kilowatt hour, and it slightly increases, and that's just the inflation on that $16 million a year for O&M costs. And you can see it's there, but it's pretty minimal. Then after 30 years, you see the real dramatic drop-off in price. And down below in the red line, we see the real 2013 dollars, and that's that decrease in relative power cost that we're seeing there. And again, that drops off after 30 years as well. So it's real important not just to put the cost of power up there, but also look at it, what it would be competing with the energy it would be offsetting when it comes online. And for that, we're using a real simple natural gas generation comparison. We've built a model to compare what the natural gas price might be compared to Susitna-Wetonda over time. We've done more extensive, we're working on more extensive, more complex modeling, how it integrates with the rail belt utilities and their power cost. And that is, it's an ongoing effort. We've been seeing good results from that, and it's really matched up with this more simple result here, and I really like the simple model for these types of presentations, because we can all understand, we can look at it and make sense. It's not one of these, you know, black boxes, trust me, this is the power cost that makes sense. It's pretty easily vetted. And the results of this comparison with natural gas generation is it's competitive with natural gas in the early years, and it becomes much lower cost over time. An important caveat here is the future natural gas prices are unknown. We're presenting a range in this presentation coming up, but it's important to keep in your mind. And for the model itself, we're assuming a constant efficiency and fuel cost for natural gas generation. We're assuming a heat rate of about 8,000 kilowatt hours, which is fairly conservative, and a non-fuel cost, again, of 3 cents per kilowatt hour. So again, this doesn't model building new power plants or capital turnover in those plants, just a real simple 3 cents per kilowatt hour and 8,000 BTU per kilowatt hour heat rate. And the fun slide here, the natural gas price forecast. It's real important for us to have a natural gas price forecast, and the one we picked for our base case was starting at $6.50 in 2013 and increasing at 4% annually. This is 1.5% greater than the inflation rate we're using of 2.5%. But realistically, future natural gas prices are probably better represented with a range. And for this range, we use $6 to $12, just increasing at the rate of inflation. And I don't think I need to convince this particular committee about how uncertain these natural gas prices are based on the meetings you've had prior. There's been a lot of discussion about this. There's a lot of uncertainty. But I think it's real important to kind of think about the uncertainty and think about where it is as we look at these next couple slides. It's really the big driver of where these benefits might fall. And I know the instinct is to key in on that baseline natural gas price forecast, but it'd also be good to grab the top and the bottom, this $6 and $12 for potential future prices. So this is our natural gas price forecast graphically with the range, and it's kind of hard to see up on the monitor, but hopefully on our paper we can see it a little bit better. The dark line in the middle is the base case natural gas price forecast that starts at $6.50 and increases at 4%, and the range around it is the $6 to $12 increasing at 2.5%. Oops, went the wrong way. So what we're seeing on this next slide is to start with the net natural gas power cost. This dark line is essentially just taking that power cost that we saw, or that natural gas price, and running through that 3 cent per kilowatt hour inflated and then 8,000 heat rate. And then the bars around it are the $6 to $12. And you can see that with the base case natural gas scenario, so Sitwatana Hydro equals the cost of power after 12 years. If it's a higher price scenario, much, much sooner. And the important note is here, after that, as natural gas continues to rise, even with inflation, no kind of increasing costs beyond just, you know, the normal tick of inflation, so Sitwatana becomes much, much cheaper over time. And then after this 30 years, once the debt's paid off, once the project is still producing lots of, you know, the same amount of power, the cost goes way down. And that's when we really see the huge benefits of this project. I'm going to go back to this one. And I'm going to show this same slide two different ways. This first time I'm showing in nominal dollars. This is dollars of the day. So this is what we'll be paying at the time it takes inflation into account. The next slide is showing the exact same information, but it's showing in real dollars. Right now we're not spending 2024 dollars. We've only got 2013 dollars in our pockets. So to really understand what these means, or what this means to our current bill, this is the better way of understanding it. This is what it would cost now. And you can see that Sitwatana comes on at a little under 14 cents and decreases in real terms, whereas the natural gas generation is, in this term, pretty flat because we were only increasing it for inflation other than that base case, which was going up by just a little bit more. The other very significant benefit, and it's often overlooked, but I think it's a really neat component of this project, is it reduces the uncertainty of the power costs that Alaska ratepayers will pay for electricity in the future. So Sitwatana is expected to offset about half of the generation on the rail bill, and with that stable stable price of power coming out of there, it has reduces the uncertainty about what ratepayers may be paying. The following chart I'm going to show compares essentially just two simplified, it's a demonstrative chart, it's real simple, but it compares what the range of power cost would be if it was all natural gas, that $6 to $12 range, versus half natural gas and half hydro at the $6 to $12 range. And again, hopefully it shows up better on paper than it does up on the slide.
Nick, we have a question. Senator Bertucci? Oh.
Yes.
One of the beauties of hydro is it's one of those projects where tomorrow's ratepayers can pay for funding. What did the 50-year outlook do for your
pricing as opposed to paying off the project in 30 years?
I don't have that number directly in front of me. We've calculated that before. I can get that to you.
Significantly on the power cost at the onset?
It does. It through the chair, it drops the power costs in the initial year significantly. Pushes more of those costs off into the future. I think a good example would be a home mortgage. You know, to get kind of the relative impact of that going from a 20-year to a 30-year, it would be the same kind of impact going from a 30-year to a 50-year.
Be interesting to see that if that's possible.
The chair certainly, yeah.
When we get that to the committee, we'll all distribute it to the committee members.
Okay, so drawing attention back to this slide, we can see that the it's kind of hard to see on this one, but we can see that the range of power costs is a much narrower band going into the future. This allows for increased certainty for homeowners and businesses to make investments because they have a better sense of what the power costs will be in the future. And the economic takeaways is just kind of a brief sum up of what we've talked about. So Syntotonic can greatly reduce future power costs and certainty. A lot of the issues that we're dealing with today, what the cost of power will be, what the cost of energy will be in Alaska, this takes a significant chunk of that and makes it more certain. And that certainty prices, we think, will be competitive with natural gas in the early years and, again, become much cheaper later on. And the last bullet here is it will equal the power cost of natural gas in the base case scenario after just 12 years. And I think I'm going to turn it back over to Mr. Dyock for the 2013 goals and milestones.
Thank you, Nick.
Yes, thank you. So what are we going to be doing this year? Perhaps as important as anything is continue the outreach efforts that we have undertaken with the stakeholders and the landowners in the area. Make sure that they're fully informed. We get their input and adjust whatever we're doing, accordingly. The big ticket item for us is, of course, implementing the revised study plan. We have reimbursable services agreements with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, not only for the fisheries work but also for some of the major issues related to land, so with moose, caribou, and other fur bearers. They're doing some studies for us there. Certainly, logistical support when you have 180 people out in the field and trying to do it safely is a very important aspect. So we're looking at some field camps similar to what we had in the 1980s. A lot of helicopter support. And then very important is making sure we have permits from the different landowners, Bureau of Land Management. State owns some land, and of course the Alaska Native landowners, the regional and village corporations. A really important part too that we have to start thinking down the road of how do you minimize your risk on a going forward basis, and we're looking at what's called a resources and procurement plan. So it's a mechanism whereby you look at and you develop a plan so that you limit your risk not only for the costs of the detailed engineering design, but more importantly, how do you structure everything so your construction costs, which are really your big driver here, can be done in a way that limits the risk to the state. So that's an important piece that we've been working on. We hope to plan to complete that this year. We've also been working with the Rail Belt Utilities, looking at a precedence agreement. Without their support, without a buyer for the project, you really don't have a project. So that's another key part. And then, as I mentioned, from an engineering design perspective, we're into refinement and design optimization. So we still have some geotechnical work ahead of us this coming year. And that wraps it up. I'm certainly be happy to take any questions.
I have one question. I'll get it in here while the creative juices are flowing, maybe some of the other committee members. But I might have not heard you clearly in the beginning. Does a hydro project complement wind generation?
Mr. Chairman, The short answer is yes. Wind has a lot of uncertainty associated with it. It could be blowing one minute and then not the next minute. A hydropower project has the ability to vary its generation very, very rapidly. Within seconds, you can get literally 10, 20, 30 megawatts of change. The issue is how fast can you make changes so as not to have an adverse effect on the environment downstream. So we'll be looking at what those limits are, and then that will set the bounds. So within those bounds, assuming that we develop them with other parties, then that would give us what flexibility that we have. And we're looking at worst case scenarios, and then we're also, which worst case in a sense from an environmental perspective, which would be the maximum flexibility where we lose a whole transmission line, say to the Kenai Peninsula. What happens if you lose 125 megawatts? Bradley Lake suddenly goes offline, and now you have to have some other mechanism to meet that. So we can do that, and then the project will be able to, if the wind suddenly stops and we get more wind, and with the amount of wind that we have in our system now, it's really not much of a problem. But in other places where they have a huge penetration of wind on the order of 20 to 30% of the systems, if the wind suddenly drops, it can collapse your transmission system. And so the hydro has the ability to step up and meet that immediate need.
Thank you. It'd be kind of interesting to see how fast you can throttle up, the hydro. Senator Giesel has a question.
Yes, you talked a lot about, of course, the generation of the power. What aspect of the transmission lines are the responsibility of the Susitna-Wantana project?
Through the chair, Senator, we have developed a plan for transmission lines that would take the power to the intertie. And so from the intertie on, that would not be part of FERC's oversight. So they are responsible for what's called primary transmission lines from the project. So it would be from Wantana, and primarily we would like to go straight east, or west I should say, to get to the intertie, and then we're looking at having one line north as well that would tie up, go up to the Denali Highway and over. So we're still looking at those studies though, but that would be FERC's jurisdiction.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes, ma'am.
So you're describing a loop then for reliability?
Yes, that would be, through the chair, Senator, yes, that's what we're looking at. Is we don't need to have that third line from the perspective of just getting the power, but if one of the lines goes out, we need to be able to address the make sure that we have that reliability. We're still also looking at having two or three lines in the same corridor as well. So we haven't abandoned that. We're looking at all options at this point.
Thank you.
Any other questions from committee members? Well, I would like to thank the folks from Alaska Energy Authority today for coming this morning and giving us a good update on the Susitna-Wantana Hydro Project. I appreciate it. Did a great job. And with that, our next meeting is Tuesday, February 21st. Thursday, February 21st, 7:30 with the Alaska Independent Power Producers. There will be an overview presented by Mike Kraft and Duff Mitchell. And with that, we're gaveling out, and it's 8:28.